G'day everyone, welcome to the show. This is Roll With Punches podcast and it is Sunday. I am your host, Tiffany Cook. And thank goodness, guess who's back with us? Bobby Cappuccio. He's here every Sunday except for the last two because he's had a lot on. He's been moving house, he's been doing the things. And you know, when you see someone that you haven't seen for a little while and you realise how much you miss them? That is how I felt. So we have a big chat today. We workshop some should Tiff get a second cat problems. Should Tiff get a second cat? So maybe you can all jump into my Facebook group, Roll With The Punches podcast, and let me know if Tiff should, in fact, get a second cat for young Bear. We also talk a bit about evolution, the changes, for reflecting back on the fact that I'm rocketing towards 500 episodes of the podcast and how I perceive how I've changed and evolved over this time. God, what a ride it's been. What a ride. Talk about a lot of stuff. Anyway, I'll get out of the way so you can go and listen. Big love. Nobody wants to go to court. And don't my friends at Testart Family Lawyers know that? They offer all forms of alternative dispute resolution. Their team of Melbourne family lawyers have extensive experience in all areas of family law, de facto and same-sex couples, custody and children, family violence and intervention orders, property settlements and financial agreements. Testart is in your corner. So reach out to Mark and the team at www.testartfamilylawyers.com.au.
Hey, Tiffany, welcome back. It's good to be back here with you after a little bit of a layoff.
I'd like to say it's wonderful to see you, Bobby, but I can't see your face because you've got to have your camera off.
Yeah, I'm hiding behind some bushes in the middle of a car park. That sounds dodgier than it actually is. It's just that I'm in transit. I just got done with the seminar, so I had to pull over into a place where I feel like I'm hoping I won't be disturbed and I could do car park podcasts.
This is
season one.
You know what? This is the, like, listen up, everyone. This is what happens when you commit to things and you're willing to make it work. Like, if you knew the cogs in the Bobby machine that were all simultaneously turning in his life right now, you would be like, why doesn't he just have a few weeks off podcasting? But nah, he's committed to the process.
Believe me, I've thought about it. More than commitment, I'd probably just miss you too much. That's the real story.
I know, right? I would miss you. I would miss you a lot. When I said, hey, do you want, like, do you need to have a little bit of, you know, do you want a little break over this one? Because it was also Christmas. Like, Christmas is coming up. It just is, it is, there is manicness in the air. Like, everyone, it's busy. There's a lot more social stuff going on. And there's, for me, there's this looming sense of hurriedness that comes from nowhere with this time of year. I feel like it's an energy in the year. You know, a couple of added things in my calendar, but just the energy of this looming deadline. And I don't know where it comes from, but it's there.
Talking about Christmas. So I got a bit of a Scrooge message. Not from a Scrooge, someone like calling me out on being a Scrooge in a lovely way. One of my dearest friends in the world, Anna Marie, sent me a text. She's like, oh, I just got finished watching a season of Afterlife with Ricky Gervais.
Oh, love it.
And she's like, you know, his character really reminds me a lot of you. And I was like, oh, you mean because, like, I'm funny like Ricky Gervais? She's like, no, he's much funnier than you. But it's kind of like his character has such a big heart, but he seems to hate everyone and absolutely everything. I was like, thank you.
Well, humbug, on the upside, I love Ricky Gervais and I love him in that film.
I think that is one of the most honest and deeply poignant and sentimental shows I have watched in such a long time. That was so beautifully done. And the fact that some parts were so cringeworthy, because I don't watch cringeworthy stuff for the sake of watching that. But when there is a greater context, it's like you're going down the rabbit hole into the darkest places this guy has been because he can't come to grips with losing the single most important person in his life. It's his sensitivity and his beauty that made him so unbearably like antagonistic at times.
Yeah. I watched the series twice and he's quite talented in how he portrayed that and put that together. I think like that such a balance of
genius,
humor and angst and empathy and heartache. Oh, like that's clever. That was everything rolled into one and a dog. So I was really happy.
The dog. Yeah, I mean, dog. Just nothing is more human than a dog.
Speaking of animals, I think you saw it. You saw it just before, but
I did.
Yeah, there's a potential disaster looming. There's a potential disaster, and I don't know if I'm about to act on a strike of genius or another detrimental bloody decision.
No, you should do it. You should definitely do it, and you should do it for the following reason. Someone who grew up with cats, when you first bring him in, there is going to be a bit of contention. You're going to have to keep them separated, introduce them slowly. Bat is going to go mental. The claws are going to come out. But she's young enough that after a while, they'll probably grow close. He's a male. She's a female. That does tend to help the dynamic where they're not as territorial as it would be if it was same sex.
Do you know what his name is? What his name is already? What's
Rudolph?
Cupid.
Oh.
Cupid. Oh. I think I'd probably keep that too. I kept Bear's adopted name.
Oh, Cupid.
Mm.
Lovely. He might have a little arrow for Bear.
Yeah. You know, when I first got Bear as a kitten and I did all the reading and it's like, one cat is a problem. You should get two. Yep. Two cats are easier.
Definitely.
And I fostered a second one for a while, but what I really, especially after losing Coach a month before, Bear was very special to me and I really connected with her. And I just really yearned for that one-on-one connection. And so it was very stressful going through the process of having the other kitten fostering. And I had to keep them separate at that stage. And, you know, it wasn't like, you know, they were a bit like, bit territorial. But so I didn't keep the other foster. I kept her for a couple of weeks and then gave her back. But now Bear's a bit older and she's super loving, but she's also like you can see in my studio right now, and the listeners can't, but in my studio I've got these acoustic paneling on my wall, and she now has resorted to ripping them completely off the wall, and she picks it. So there's all of these there's just balls of foam across all of my floor every time I come in here, and and the boards are ripped down. So I'm like, okay, you know,
that's likely to decrease a bit if she gets integrated with another cat.
But then I think to myself, what if she's not the devil's spawn? What if the devil's spawn is yet to come, and the devil's spawn is Cupid wrapped up in a bloody pretty bow, and then I get Cupid, and Cupid's like, ha, got you now. And Cupid scratches the shit out of my whole house. And I'm like, oh.
You definitely should cancel your Netflix subscription.
Why's that?
Devil spawn yet to come. It's like somebody's watching too many late night horror flicks. What is more than likely to happen is you'll have a little bit of territorial issues. They'll start to integrate. They'll become close. They'll be best mates. They'll be a little bit more calm. You're not going to lose any affection, because when they're calm, they'll probably be more affectionate individually and collectively towards each other and you than one cat would be. Two cats generally work out better than one. Three cats, you're pushing it. Any more than that, you're that person whose parents tell their kids, do not go near that house. That lady's crazy.
Lisa Sagan, shout out to you, Lisa. Lisa Sagan's got three, and she sent me a photo. Oh,
no, three, you're on the cusp. You're not quite there yet. Just it's the cusp.
I reckon she'll have another one in 6 months.
Well, that's going a little bit too far. That's a sign of a deeper issue.
Yeah. Who would have thought, hey? Crazy cat.
Get the cat. Get Cupid.
The other thing is, like, ideally, when I first got Bear, I was like, well, I still want to get a whippet at one point. Should I just get a whippet and she can just befriend the whippet? And then, that's a lot more work and commitment. And I just really don't feel like I'm ready. I would like another year before I'm going back into puppy chaos. Puppy chaos.
Yeah, you know, that's
so many decisions. Being an adult is a lot of decisions, and I get overthinky with decisions, right? So what I would ideally like to do is close my eyes, transport myself into 6 months' time, see what these two cats look and feel like and what life is like, then come back here, then make the decision. Then teleport myself out to a year's time with a puppy and see how that feels, and then compare what two cats and a puppy and one cat and a puppy would be like, and be able to weigh up all of that before making my decision. And then part of me goes, you know, I could reach out to this rescue place and go, can I just foster Cupid and see how it was? But I know that that's not an answer either, because, like, there were the first few weeks / maybe even a couple of months with Bear, it just got to a point where I was like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to settle into this. Like, this is chaos. There's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of frustration. Well, and now I'm head over heels in love.
Yeah. Aside from teleporting across space and time, that seems very reasonable. What is the biggest issue? Like, what are you really afraid of?
Commitment.
Yeah, but that's easy to say. What is it about the commitment? What does commitment expose you to? Or in what way does this make you vulnerable that you're kind of hesitant about?
Well, I think what I think about not getting a second one is not giving her, not, you know, on times when I'm not here, like, is this the best life for her? Is this the best? Does this... Like, I was talking about this with Bill the other day, funnily enough. I was saying, you know, like, it's to commit. When I got coach years ago, six and a half years ago, nearly 7 years ago now, that was, like, I wouldn't commit to animals. I wouldn't commit to anything that I could lose and attach to. Attachment's really hard. And so part of the getting a dog process was, you're going to settle down, you're going to commit to this animal and have this thing in your life that you love that one day you'll lose, and fucking that came around way faster than it should have. Mm-hmm. But,
and that was hard.
That was super hard. But when I said to Bill, you know, even just the having it, I got the kitten because the kitten is, I didn't want to lose the progress I'd made of having that in my life in a way, walking, coming home to something, having connection. But even... You know, and a cat's easier than a dog because you can go on holidays and it's easier for someone to come and care for the cat than care for a dog and take it for walks and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it's just a little bit easier. But I said it's still for someone who's very independent and has always had a thing about attaching and attachment. I feel very aware that, like, I can't just come home and be busy. Like, I have to invest time in the cat. I have to connect with the cat and show the cat, like, the cat is a being. And so it's just being enough. It's just making sure, like, it's not just a selfish decision to make me happy. It's I'm giving the cat a life. And what's the best life for the cat?
Well, if you were a cat, I can't believe I'm saying this. What would you want? On the times when you were gone, would you want a companion? Because when it comes to taking a risk and letting an animal into your heart and your life, you've already taken the biggest risk. You've done that. The big risk is, do I get a cat or not get a cat? You've already gotten said cat. Right. So it's talking about bringing in another cat, which you're basically doing just what you've already done. So it's not increasing your risk, and it may be good for Bear in the process. It may actually enhance the quality of her life and his and yours. You've already done the hardest bit.
Who knew we were going to be having a cat therapy session in this show?
This is not the direction I thought this conversation was going to go.
This was not intended.
Maybe anyway. You should just start writing a blog called Two Cats and a Whippet. And you can imaginably project yourself into the future and talk about what that would be like and just try it on.
I've been looking at the cat rescue page, like waiting for it. It was internally, it's like I don't half made this year. It was like as soon as a cat that catches my eye comes up, and hopefully a boy, I would consider it. So it was like, you know, when you're pretending that you're not looking for something, but you are.
Mm-hmm.
So that had already started to happen. So this morning when I saw that picture and I was like, oh my goodness, he's a little apricotty, but not super apricotty. He's like a funny little color. He's not super orange, but he's a little bit. And I was like, I picture them together. I'm like, oh, that's a really cute dynamic. Those two colors are cute. Mm-hmm. So yeah, anyway, shit.
You don't want a super orange cat. That's blinding.
And then just before I was like, oh no. And then I've got a dark cat with dark hair and a light cat, and then all my clothes are fucked. But then I realized that also Bear's coat is actually her fur, the first half of her fur is white. So if you wet her, her fur is actually white and the tips of it are black and gray.
How often are you wetting her?
Only that one time that she fell in the toilet. So. So
yeah.
I've only got that
and
to go by.
And underneath that, her fur is blue. Well, I don't think that's the case.
So I was like, oh, well, I've already got light and dark hair all over my shit, so it doesn't matter.
That is an important consideration. You are going to have to invest in rollers.
Yeah, I know.
Quite a lot. Yep. You might have to double your roller investment. But it's a good decision. And it's ultimately your decision. I would talk it over with Bear, get her thoughts on it, and then just decide.
I'm sick of having to not be the boss anymore, though. Like, she's the boss of everything. Everything, Bobby. Everything in
You're
my
surprised?
Life now.
Like, when you were getting a cat, you didn't think that was going to be the issue?
No. No, I did not. I didn't know how bossy they were. They are so bossy.
You had no knowledge of cats, did you?
Nah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just knew that toilet training wasn't such an issue.
Just stick them in a box, they're fine.
Anyway, moving swiftly along from the cats, if there's any listeners still listening that aren't cat people, don't worry, we're not going to talk about this the whole time. Just pretend we were talking about puppies.
So, segue, you know, you've learned a lot about yourself by being a pet owner twice, both with Coach and now with Bear. And
I've been a pet owner a lot. I used to have a pet snake. I used to have a pet python.
I don't really think that counts. They've got no limbic system. We're not counting them. So,
Do you know what they've got two of, though?
Eyes.
Penises.
Excuse me, what?
Snakes have two penises.
Because they're promiscuous, they're twice the fun. Like, what's the point of that?
I don't know. I didn't ask mine about it. I just know that they do. I'm surprised you don't know this. You are the wisest human in my sphere. I'm surprised
snake
you don't know
penises
about.
Is not my area of expertise, admittedly. So anyone who thinks their snake loves you, they don't. They do not have the brain structures necessary to be affectionate. You feed them, and if you stopped, you'd be food for them if they were big enough. So that's basically what you are. Anyway, so moving on from that, I don't want to, like, you know, own whatever pet you want to own. What's it to me? But experiences help shape us, and they not only help us grow, but they give birth to different aspects of us. That whole statement about be who you are.
Mm.
Well, who am I really is one question. The second is who I am genetic and immutable or aspects, or is it a construct? And then how many versions of me are there? Not talking about schizophrenia, but there's multiple versions of you. Mm. And every time you embark on a journey, different versions of you change, and certain versions of you are conceived and emerge and are shaped. So let's talk about that a little bit. How is your podcast journey? I mean, you're on what, 478, I think this is now?
478.
Yeah. So what's the difference between Tiffany episode 1 and Tiffany 478?
A completely different human being. The reason this came up is because I re-released episode 9 with Cam the other day, because I refer so many people back to that. And that initial conversation I had with Dr. Cam McDonald on PH360 Epigenetics was a really great overview of all of the types, what it means to us, what our biology is needing and wanting, and how to move and how to, you know, how to connect. And it's just a great overview. So I've had a lot of conversations with him, but that one, and I was like, saves people scrolling back 470 episodes. Re-released it, and I said to you, I listened to a little bit of it, and it weirdly made me, it made me cringy hearing the difference in myself, and I couldn't even describe what's different. I just, there was something in the tone, I guess maybe the confidence, the whatever was emotionally and mentally.
The essence of how you showed up.
Yeah. And I was like,
the it factor.
Yeah, right. And so what's interesting to me is going, there's this change that's not deliberate. And this is looking, reflecting back over what I kind of asked when I remember asking Harps when I was back then, going, what do I need to do to get better? Because I don't know what that is now. I've gotten comfortable in the starting of this, and now I want to get better at it, but I'm actually not sure what that is. And so now there's change, and I can hear it so definitely, but I can't even pinpoint what is the change in that person. Influence, understanding, the way that I speak, I guess the way that I express, the way that I think while I'm expressing, the amount of attention that's on my words versus my thoughts.
Is so super, super insightful. There's a lot to unpack there, because so often when it comes to anything, when it comes to weight loss, when it comes to developing a skill, it's like, what do I do? What's the thing? What's the technique? We used to get this a lot in sales. There's a salesperson who's excelling. Well, what do you do? What do you say at this point? Mm. But there's so many integrated skills that support that outcome. It's not that one sheet of paper. It's not that one question. It's not that one technique. And a lot of times it's not what you're doing. It's who you are being. You're doing the same exact things. So I remember I was working with an organization where they wanted to script all the salespeople's presentations down to the word, to the exact transitions. And this is on so many levels, I take issue with this. Mm. But the rationale was, if we can get them to say exactly what the vice president of sales would say in this situation, so much for listening and being present for someone, because no two situations are the same. But if we can get them to say the same exact things, we can get them producing consistent results. And for most people, it was disastrous. It destroyed their performance, because no two people are ever saying the same exact things. That's like saying, okay, Denzel Washington is up for a role in a new film coming out. Well, just cast me instead. What's the difference? I can memorize a script with enough repetition, enough practice. You can get me to say throughout that film exactly what Denzel Washington is saying. Am I going to give the same performance as Denzel Washington? Let me tell you something. People are going to really want their money back. There is no hope for a sequel if you cast me in that film. Denzel Washington, different story. It's not about what you say. It's all the things that are giving rise to how that's delivered.
You know what, mate? A couple of weeks ago, I had to go and do some filming for my networking group. They just wanted to make these little promo videos. And so I rocked up, didn't know anything about it, rocked up for a start. They didn't tell us to the night before. They're like, oh, wear something comfortable. You'll be dancing. I'm like, I don't fucking dance for anyone, let alone a camera. Be dancing. I was like, I might shadow box, but fucking hell. Anyway, what was really interesting was...
So who ran this program, Ellen?
I had one sentence to say. Bobby, I literally had three words to say. And what I found really interesting was I was like, out of three words, I was like, you've scripted me. I wouldn't say that. Like, all I had to say was, it ain't boring. I was like, I wouldn't say it ain't boring. I'd say it's not boring. Like, that's, but the amount of discomfort, and I couldn't say it. It didn't feel authentic to me because I'd say it ain't boring, and I felt like a fuckwit. So I'm like, I don't say ain't. I mean, I probably do, but I wouldn't with that sentence. And it was interesting to go, Jesus, you got three words to say, and one word makes you feel like you can't be authentic. So scripting for a bloody sales thing, of course.
I mean, obviously, there's a commitment to process. There's understanding how each step in the process leads and guides the guest or the prospect through that whole sales experience. And obviously, it creates duplication throughout the organization. But that's about 5%. It's developing that salesperson and the intrinsic factors that allow you to show up and authentically communicate. That's what makes the difference. Stanford Meiser was one of the most revered acting coaches in the world. And I loved what he said about the essence of acting, where acting is about living truthfully. It's not about playing a role. It's about living truthfully in an imaginary circumstance.
Ooh.
To where the circumstance might be imaginary. Like Bruce Willis is not really going to save the world from an asteroid, but it's like, how would Bruce Willis authentically show up if that situation was actually real? Not his character. How would he act in that situation? How would he truly show up? And that's why you forget a lot of times in a great film that you're watching an actor.
Yeah.
You get sucked into the story and you're able to suspend disbelief, where when the acting's terrible, you're quite aware of the fact that you are watching actors portray a situation and a character. And I think that's what happens when you podcast or sell, or when you settle in after being invested within a relationship, you start to change.
Yeah.
And it's those changes that either support or detract from what you're trying to accomplish. What do you guess it would be with you? What is the main element that has helped you to transform and become episode 478, Tiffany Cook?
I've settled into the trust in, and I always had this philosophy that, like, very, very quickly I learned that at best I might jot a couple of ideas for topics or questions down, but I never planned anything. I already had and expressed when I talked to people that I had this trust in my own curiosity. I guess the breadth of my understanding of life and the things that I have now to reference in understanding conversations, I have so much more to reflect and offer into the conversation. But it is the idea that I can sit down and not, you know, I had Bruce Perry on yesterday. I had a conversation with Bruce. Wow, like, he was on the top of my hit list of people I wanted to speak to, and I've been really...
Oh, wow, yeah. I want to hear about how that went.
Oh, it was amazing, you know, like, God, I feel so blessed. I just spent the afternoon going, fucking hell, like, I just sat with him for an hour, and I remember asking, I was like, go to a couple of people, hey, have you got questions, sing out, but I didn't even look at any questions. I was just me and him having a conversation, and it was just like, fuck any of the questions I had. It didn't even feel like a podcast. I was like, what do you think about this? And I was just like, I just want to borrow your mind and your ideas for a moment. And I guess really just connecting with people, and it's, God, I just love it. Just love it.
So, I'm going to wait for the podcast. I don't want to ask you for spoilers on this, but Bruce Perry is someone who I'm personally quite interested in. I finished his book that he wrote with Oprah.
Yes, yes.
So Amy's going to borrow that book.
Yep. Everyone should read that book. It's so brilliant.
It gives context and understanding. And if you could read that book, see, here's the thing. That book is likely on a superficial level. I think if you read that with vulnerability and you don't feel threatened by it, intuitively, so much of that will ring true. Mm. Superficially, if you're reading that book, it may contradict a lot of the standardized reactions and philosophies outside of context that you offer to any situation in the world. And if you could just suspend that, I think that book has a lot to teach people, not just about others, but about yourself. So there was a post on social media, and it was very interesting, where the author said, don't expect honesty from someone who is perpetually lying to themselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what I got out of that is we so often in our development, and unwittingly, we don't even know. We're not going, okay, today I'm going to lie to myself. I will tell myself I am handsome, even though this is the worst hair day I've had on record. You know, we don't do that, but we unwittingly and subconsciously allow our cognitive biases and distortions to overtake us. We craft stories. And a lot of times that is to either make the best out of a bad situation. It's to mask something we don't want to face. It's to protect us from something.
Mm.
And you look in the comments, I've been off social media for days and just getting back in, and you look in the comments and it's like, I was married to a liar. Liars can never be. I'm like, where is this coming from? The person's not even talking about that. And it automatically defaults to, liars are horrible. I've been a victim of it. This is, no one's talking about you here. Mm-hmm. Unless you're the person lying to yourself. And it's like people have these default responses, and even when the context doesn't fit. You know, like if your default response is apples, you know, when you go to a steakhouse and you're screaming about apples, you're gonna be a little bit out of place.
Yeah.
There's context to everything. So it's if you can just suspend that and say, what am I curious about here? What do I want to learn? Because what's obvious to me is people who have this rigid structure of how people are, or better yet, should be, or how they are or should be, and it's like this go-to simplified default, these are probably people who are really struggling. And that's probably their lie that they're telling themselves, that this is an absolute truth that applies to every single person, regardless of who that person is, psychologically, biologically, situationally. And I'm going to apply this linear, non-binary, simplistic rule to every aspect of life. Now, sometimes that does absolutely work, but a lot of other times, I think those are people who are struggling, Tiff.
Mm-hmm. One thing that's been on my mind lately, or that I've been mulling over for myself and my own situation and beliefs and circumstances, so this is not, I'm not pointing the finger at anybody else, but is the responsibility of the assumptions I've made of people and situations. So looking at the repeated patterns of not optimal things that I've attracted into my life, or beyond that, that I've created. So it's going, hang on, I'm not just attracting this. So we go from this thing of going, oh, this is fucked, this stuff happened to me. And then we can reach this place where we go, oh, I somehow have attracted this, subconsciously or consciously, whatever. If you want to be a little bit woo-woo and a little bit spiritual, or just have a bit of responsibility, okay, I'm attracting this because of this. So I've got something that I can work on now and observe. But then I've gone, I'm not just attracting these things, I'm actually creating. I'm creating because I'm responsible for my boundaries and for my half of the interaction that causes mm-hmm. their reaction to my interaction. So it's not just about, oh, I've invited a bad situation or a bad, or, you know, or, you know, not optimal situation and a not optimal person into my life. I've actually, like, I've played a really active part in that. And so that same type of person, so then it's not about, oh, I've got to know who's a bad person so I can not be around them. It's like, no, you can be around all of the people. You've just got to learn how to be strong enough and know your own interactions and boundaries and just start to understand, I don't know, the signs and the way that I operate and function. I'm responsible for that.
Well, there's a lot of ways you can look at that where these painful situations, if they've given you that level of insight, there is a benefit and an advantage, and you've leveraged it, and they were essential for your trajectory.
Yeah. I'm grateful for them. There's some
unless,
fucking,
of course, this is someone who's like really hurt you irreparably, and that's like, okay, well, that sucks. And then there's the whole, am I really creating this? And there, I think there's a distinction between what is true and what is useful. Yeah. I think sometimes bad things happen where you have a bad person come into your life and you have something quite unfortunate, and there was nothing you could have done to avoid it, regardless of how much self-help tells you otherwise. But is that useful after the fact? Because if you think, well, I've partially created this, that's going to put you in a different frame of mind.
Yeah.
And then if you feel you had no other option and you were completely victimized by it.
So I think it's important to, for me, it's important to go, there's no power in saying there's no responsibility. There's a difference between fault and responsibility. Not my fault. Wasn't aware, had no awareness, didn't realize, didn't deliberately do stuff, didn't know what I was in the middle of. Fuck, I'm grateful for it. And now it's my responsibility. Now I see my responsibility in it. I don't hate myself for it. I don't self-loathe because of it, because at the time, in the with the level of awareness I had, I didn't know what I was in the middle of, and I didn't have any capabilities to do anything any differently. So there's nothing negative about that, but there's no power in saying it wasn't my fault. I can't change. Now I can change. Now the same thing could happen and I'm different. So there's a positive. And I think deliberately choosing our outlook and level of responsibility on something, it comes down to a decision. It's a decision to have a particular mindset, and we teach our mind to think that way.
Well,
and
then
there's power or there's victimization.
This is what I'm curious about. I'm curious if there is a benefit from holding two of those perspectives in mind at the same exact time.
Bobby, because are you coming back to fucking paradox again?
I'm coming back to paradox again because...
When are we going to pack this shit up?
Never.
I love you.
I think I'm going to change the name of the podcast from the Self-Help Antidote to the Self-Help Paradox. And... No, because there's two ways of exercising or framing responsibility. There's people that frame it, it's my responsibility. I have the ability to respond regardless of what or who or how I ended up in this situation. And then there's fucking hell, it's my responsibility. I've got, and there's all this paralyzing anger. And I think acknowledging it is not my fault might actually help yield greater responsibility, because it stops us from going through that unproductive pattern rather, of it's all my fault. I've done this. I'm guilty. Very often children frame situations like a parent's divorce like that. It's my fault. So it's not your fault, but that's the only way you can represent it, because otherwise your parents are highly imperfect and they're not predictable, they're not dependable, and that's terrifying. if they're your primary caregiver. So of course it's me. So not only is it my fault, but there's something about me that has caused this. That's a quite destructive pattern that interferes with responsibility. And sometimes we run that pattern perpetually, even as adults. We don't examine it unless something is absolutely your fault, and take responsibility for that and that and own up to it. It's your fault. Mm-hmm. But anyway, but for the things that are not our fault, there might be value in just saying, okay, that was not my fault. Now, what do I do about it? Because it is my responsibility.
Yeah. And maybe this is like, maybe this, the needle moves on this from one thing to another, like it's circumstance. So in this instance, here's where I need to land on whether or not something's my fault. Doesn't mean that the next, you know, like I think when I'm adopting, taking in information and adopting beliefs or strategies or the, you know, the most optimal way for me to think or do or behave based on anything I'm learning, which is a fucking lot lately because I'm talking to brilliant people every day, and everything that comes, everything that I've spoken about on this show, good, bad or otherwise, has changed and influenced me whether I like it or not. I put a post up the other day and it said, "You, by the time you finish reading this, you will be different." And then I put a big ramble on about it because I'd just finished my 28-day program. Whether you've changed or not, you're already different because you've sat in, these people have sat in 5 workshops with me. They've told stories. They've looked at whether they've, in their interpretation, succeeded or failed on particular things. They've heard ideas and strategies. They've considered new angles. Whether or not your day-to-day has changed, your reference of what's going on has undoubtedly changed and will continue to do so. From the minute we started talking today to right now, all of the words that have been said, I won't know it because it's not huge, it doesn't feel huge, but that has influenced and changed me. That shit sits in my mind and just churns over, and when I look at the world, those new words and thoughts and ideas are now in there.
Like, I think that's different. Insightful. I believe that that is true. Just listening to you, I personally believe you've changed for the better, Tiffany. Just who you are now compared to how you got onto this podcast. I'm enjoying this version of you. I just want to point out that whatever growth trajectory you had in your 400 plus episodes, when you first started, you did not have a cat. And now you have a cat.
Or Bobby, or curly hair.
Or hair. Well, you have, well, it's just wavier and longer now. You had hair.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying that, you know, I know that correlation is not causality, but maybe the key to positive growth is get a cat and curl your hair.
All right, well, there you go. Something for all you listeners to action. Get the rollers out.
Feline wave effect to personal. Feline wave growth method.
Name of the show.
To actualize your hopes and dreams.
You better grow your hair, Bobby, or you're going to get left behind, bro.
I don't think that's an option for me anymore.
No?
No, my hair over the past few weeks has really gotten thinner.
Speaking of
long, I don't know if it's a bad haircut, it's just stress or something.
Speaking of long hair, I went and saw Guns N' Roses last week.
I know, you did. You posted it.
That was so amazing. Yeah. Very amazing. You know what I was thinking? This is another thing. It's like, I wouldn't have thought like this if I had watched Guns N' Roses 2 years ago. I'm watching Slash play this incredible guitar solo. Incredible. And his hands and his fingers are just fucking going hell for leather at the speed of light. And I was like, and what I was visualizing is all of his brain centers firing and the effect on his brain of him playing that music, being in the music, performing, thinking that way. I was just like, wow, the effect on somebody who gets to do that, who's trained their body and mind to think like that and to be in the moment. Like, that is therapeutic. And I was like, God, you're a nerd. Just fucking listen to the music.
Developing that level of skill and wiring your brain for that performance. You know, I'm fond of saying I'm a bit redundant with the payoff is in the process. And we always come back to do the work.
Mm.
And it's like, why is doing the work seemingly such an uphill struggle for people? On the one hand, it could be fear, it could be doubt, it could be conflicting intentions. On the other hand, if what we're doing is aligned with what it is that's most meaningful to us, doing the work is extremely rewarding. I think people gravitate towards that naturally as a form of intrinsic motivation. I mean, self-determination theory would sort of support that, I reckon, where let's take a musician. When you know you're a musician from the time you're a little kid, you have to practice incessantly, but you don't just have to. You look for opportunities to. And you might have somebody who's on the way to becoming, I mean, not a member of Guns N' Roses, but they're on their way to becoming extremely talented and skilled at something that very few people possess that level of talent and skill in. Yet their parents and teachers might actually look at them and go, they are lazy. This person is so lazy. They just don't do the work because they're not doing their math problems. But then again, if mom and dad had to practice 8 hours a day, every day, no breaks in between, to become super proficient at an instrument, they would probably give up. So the same thing that you're accusing someone of, you're guilty of, but you're like, who cares? What's the value in playing the guitar? So for one person, playing the guitar is the single most important imperative, and that guitar pulls you toward it. For another person, it's frivolous. It's a waste of time. It's something he's obviously doing for fun. It's not fun. It's extremely challenging. And that trajectory, especially in the beginning, is likely filled with failure and frustration, but it's so aligned with values and identity. So where does work ethic come in there? So if we're not doing the work, I think it's a matter of asking, well, is there something we're afraid of? Or, you know, it's kind of like the story of Matt Emmons. And Martin Rooney tells the story about Matt Emmons quite a bit. And I think you know, the person who originally talked about this was Professor Robert Gilbert at Montclair University. He's a fascinating guy. And in 2004, Matt Emmons was selected as the marksman to compete in the rifle competition for the United States. Now, in the last round of the competition, Matt Emmons was so far ahead of everyone else. All he had to do was hit anywhere, and I mean anywhere within the target, and he instantly would get a gold medal. But that's not his personality type. He doesn't want to hit anywhere on the target. He wanted to end the competition with a dead center bullseye. So he focused and he prepared and he put as much concentration and attention and effort into this shot as if the gold medal was absolutely dependent upon this bullseye. He exhales, squeezes the trigger, and hits the bullseye dead center. And with that, he goes to last place in the competition, goes home, no medal for the United States. Now, if you're listening to this, which I just heard that, Tiffany, you're like, what the? How is it that a guy who was so far ahead in the competition, all he had to do was hit the bloody target anywhere? You could have woken him up in the middle of the night from a drunken stupor, spun him around in a dark room, and he could hit that target. This guy goes ahead and hits a bullseye dead center and goes to last place in the competition. How's that possible? Well, he was so focused on hitting the bullseye. He was aiming at the target in the next lane over. He missed his target by a mile. How many of us are living our lives like that? We're so focused on hitting the bullseye, We're aiming at the wrong target. We're aiming at someone else's target. And then we beat ourselves up wondering why we're not doing better.
Yeah. Yeah. Fucking hell. You know what the thing about watching musicians is? There was the support band that came on first was so fucking terrible. Look, some people probably like the music. It was some Aussie punk rock band. So it was these kids just screaming in the microphones and just like the singer was like just crossing his eyes as he sung. And you couldn't understand a single word. It was just like, oh, Christ. I was like, this is fucking terrible. This is the worst thing I've seen. Anyway, then Guns
I think
and Roses.
He's my upstairs neighbor.
I Googled them and they had millions of views on their YouTube and I was like, what is going on here? Anyway, I sound like an old person. That's because I am. But then Guns N' Roses comes out, right? And they're in their late 50s to early 60s. They get on stage and it just oozes passion and just loving, like the stage presence of these guys. And I was captivated. I'm captivated watching someone become absolutely one with the performance that's coming, like Axel singing and then Slash on the guitar, just watching them be completely in the moment. And I felt the same with my friend whose niece is Tash Sultana. And I watch her play. If you haven't seen her, watch her play. She plays all of it. She's huge. And she made it by busking. She got herself famous by putting up YouTubes of her busking in the Melbourne streets. She is on billboards all over the world now. Just an amazing musician. And you watch her play and I just get captivated. I can get captivated for hours just watching her become absolutely at one with every instrument. It's almost like she's transported. I'm like, what is going, what is moving through your fucking soul as you are playing? Like her facial expressions, and I'm just mesmerized by that. And it's that more than the music catches me, but it's the what's underneath that. Like I love that. I love seeing that.
To me, my highest value, talking about values, is appreciation of beauty. So for me, witnessing things like that,
yeah,
it is a transcendent experience for me. And when we talk about responsibility, and I'm saying this understanding that some people are working in a shite job that they absolutely hate, and they're doing it many hours a week, and their family is depending on them. And I totally connect with that and I honor that. But I think everybody has a responsibility to whatever degree you can, even if it's an hour a week within your work, to connect to what do I value? Because Pine and Gilmore said years ago in their book, The Experience Economy, that work is theater. And every business is a stage. And that thing you see, there is an element of performance on with rock stars. Mm. There's Muhammad Ali, the fact that he is arguably the greatest or one of the greatest that has ever lived was not enough. There was a performance element before the fight even took place. And he also had something to say, if you're paying attention, quite an extraordinarily intelligent individual as well, observant. But whether you are a fighter, whether you are in a rock band, or whether you are a bagger at a supermarket, there is an element of performance that makes you look at something and go, I don't know what I'm seeing. I can't actually identify any one ingredient, but there is an it. I feel like I am affected. I feel like I am somehow transformed when I'm around this. And you only get that when what you're doing is aligned with who you are and what you deeply value. And you work like a demon on getting better and going deeper into that space.
To a degree, I feel like the experience as a coach, as a trainer in fitness has been the same for me. I was sitting in on Harps and Russell Jarrett the other day doing a podcast, and they were talking about training and training for human performance at any age and how we train and training within the, you know, whatever level in life you are and aging bodies and all of that, and how some people kind of don't take into account limitations or whatever, you know, how hard do we train, what is hard. And I thought, I was reflecting as I was listening, because I realized in that moment, I jotted down, I was like, how, what percentage of my, I've got 70 to 80% of my clients are over late 50s. So they're 50 to even late 60s. No, to 70, to over 70. My oldest client is 70. So 70 to 80% of them are aging. And I thought about how I train, and it's funny because it's theatrical is the element that is really happening when people come in and train with me, because it doesn't matter what they all think, they all feel like, and they are training fucking hard, like brutal, but they're all actually getting something within their limitations, but they're perceived to be doing something just outrageous. Like these 70-year-olds feel like they're training like 18-year-olds, and they are, but it's not the exercise. Like someone else, I could write down the program, give it to someone else, and the experience will be so different because it's the way it's framed, it's the way they're encouraged, it's the way I laugh or carry on in the middle of it that changes the whole dynamic of what's actually happening. And I think that it's that element that's keeping people young and making them break down their own barriers of limitations, because they're like, shit, I didn't think I could do this. I'm doing this shit that this crazy girl does. I'm doing it, and I'm bloody 70. I got my 70-year-old doing stuff that, and he comes in after a few sessions and goes, bloody, that stuff's magic. You know, I'm moving really well. I haven't got a sore back anymore. It's crazy.
You know, it's interesting when you train people like that, where in the beginning, there's such trepidation about what they perceive to be the path in front of them. And as they start to get into their program and their level of motor learning and development enhances, and they're actually able to train much harder, it doesn't seem like as much work, even though there is much more effort required.
Yeah.
They're capable of putting in far more effort than they were when they were an early stage motor learner. Yet in the beginning, they would make almost any excuse if they could to not go into the gym, because they were single-mindedly focused on the outcome. So anything in between where they were and the outcome seemed like sacrifice and work. Now the actual process of coming into the gym, even though they know they're going to have their ass busted, is something they look forward to, independent of the outcome itself.
Yeah.
People who have been training for so many years, the outcome is a consequence. It's not the intention. It's getting to work out. That's the primary intention.
Yeah.
Focus just reverses from outcome to process. And you get this. Get in a room when I used to present in the fitness industry way back when, and you'd have a room of a few hundred fitness trainers and say, okay, so true or false, goal achievement is the number one motivator. Most people like raise their hand. Yep, goal achievement. Okay, great. So how many of you right now work out consistently, no matter what? You might miss a day here and there, but you get right back on track. Every hand goes up. Okay, great. So keep your hand up if in the next 3 months you're working towards a fitness competition, you have a marathon coming up, you have a specific weight loss goal. And like at most, and I'm saying at most, 10% of the room has their hand up. So 90% of you are saying that goal achievement is the number one motivator, yet all of you work out consistently. It is such an immutable part of your life, but you don't have an impending goal. How do you explain that? It's that identity. When it becomes part of your identity, the payoff is in the process.
Yeah. Boom, there it is. Fuck, I've missed you, Bobby.
I've missed you too, Tiff. Don't like your in. Clients, it's your laugh that does it for me.
I do laugh a lot, don't I?
It's an infectious laugh. It's not quite a cackle, but it's just this this lovely, welcoming, uplifting laugh. I don't know if you can tell, but I'm in much better spirits than when I first got on.
Oh, that's so good to hear. So good to hear. Well, I can't wait till next week already.
The laugh factor.
The laugh factor. All right, well, let's wrap it up.
You know, one thing's consistent. We still have the same shitty conclusions. Feels just like old times again. It's like we've never been gone at all. It's this awkward silence.
That's one thing that hasn't progressed over the 478 episodes I've done. I can't fucking wrap up a podcast with Bobby Cappuccio in any bloody formal manner.
You know why you can't wrap up a podcast with me, Tiffany? Because there is no wrapping up. This is an ongoing intellectual, emotional journey between me, you, and the listener. I will never say goodbye. I will just say, until the next episode.
Until the next episode. Thanks for tuning in, everyone.